Okay. I want to talk a bit about rotating Bose-Einstein condensates and to understand, at least in a particular limit, perhaps some of the rather surprising phenomena one sees in them or may see in them once one has some experiments to view. The limit that we will be talking about is a limit which is somewhat different to the Thomas Fermi limit that many theorists work in. It's been a limit where the coherence length is actually rather large, and there is some rather surprising physics that's revealed in that limit. In particular, there is some relationship to the fractional quantum Hall effect, which I will talk about right at the end of the talk. So it's about rotating BECs in a limit of rather weak interactions and relationships with a rather different bit of physics. The collaborators in this work are Nicola Wilkin, who is also present at the meeting, and Rob Smith, who isn't, and we're all from Birmingham, the UK. Well, what's the fundamental question in terms of rotating condensates? Well, I'm sure different people might pose the question different ways, but the way I'd like to pose it is, how is the angular momentum distributed when one actually has a rotating condensate? Or I should perhaps say rotating bosonic atoms, because one of the conclusions will be that, in fact, one is not always condensed. So how is the angular momentum distributed? One of the things that obviously people have focused on already, and I won't give particular references because I think many speakers will be talking about this later on in the meeting, one of the particular sources or repositories of angular momentum that people have suggested are vortices in the condensate by analogy with liquid helium. And I'll have something to say about that as we go along. One can ask whether this answer depends, whether you have vortices or not, on the sign of the scattering length. And obviously, to some extent, I'm only asking that question because the answer is yes, as we all see. So it matters what the sign of the scattering length is. And finally, one might also ask whether the answer depends on the amount of angular momentum. So depending on how many quanta of angular momentum you put into your initially condensed system, does the way in which it's held change, and in fact, does one retain a condensate or not? And again, we will have something to say about that. And to give you a clue, those of you who are familiar with the field of superconductivity, there is some sort of analog of HC2 when you apply a magnetic field to a superconductor, when it stops being superconducting. There is an analog of that, we believe, lurking at high angular momentum. So those are really the questions. Let me first of all say why we have gone off in a slightly different direction from other people, namely gone in the direction of weak interactions, rather than worked in the Thomas Fermi limit, which is certainly the appropriate limit for describing much of the physics of traps that people are examining at the present. And the reason for that is principally that there are various difficulties with understanding rotating gases of atoms in harmonic traps when you use the Thomas Fermi and Gross-Pilevsky formulation. First of all, although you can describe what happens with a vortex when it's on the axis of symmetry and look at small oscillations around that position, it's really extremely difficult to consider what happens with vortices when they're significantly off the axis of symmetry due to the inhomogeneous density. And that's really quite a major problem. Another problem that sounds initially unrelated to the first one, but actually is related in a sense, is that the most straightforward approximation, which is Thomas Fermi, tends to not work very well at the edge of the trap. In other words, when the density of particles gets rather small. The relationship between these two things has been suggested by some people as perhaps providing a mechanism in the skin of the condensate for the vortices to be damped in their motion, and that may lead to all sorts of strange effects. I think perhaps other people will talk about that more thoroughly later on in the week. And I think really one should point out here that it's not just a technical difficulty in terms of doing calculations. There are really issues of principle and having a physical picture here, that somehow there's no way of gluing together, or no one's thought of it so far, gluing together pictures which allow you to think about possibly a normal fluid which gives damping at the edges of the condensate together with off-center vortices and answer, for instance, whether multiple vortices are stable or whatever. So somehow it's quite a significant and difficult problem in describing what happens in rotating gases and traps. And one controversy that's certainly come up recently has been with Rockshar's work on which predicts that vortices are unstable, in fact, in the traps. And that's controversial at the moment, and I will have very little to say about that particular controversy, except to say in our limit we find results which perhaps are interesting in that context. Okay, so those are the difficulties with treating harmonic traps with the Thomas Semigross-Podersky type of way of doing things. And really, that was the motivation that we had in part, although there were other reasons as well we'll come to as we go along, for looking at the limit of rather weak interactions. Now, weak interactions, immediately people might start to go to sleep at this point because they might think, well, we all know what an ideal Bose gas is in a parabolic well, and maybe it's rather dull to ask what happens in the limit of weak interactions. But surprisingly, perhaps not surprisingly for those of you who have pondered this thing, because of degeneracies to do with the harmonic oscillator potential, and that may be partly related to Tony Leggett's question at the end of the last talk, there are all sorts of rather special features to the harmonic oscillator potential which give rise to degeneracies in its spectrum. And it transpires that then when you turn on weak interactions, they play havoc even in this rather weakly interacting regime. The degeneracies are all lifted and one gets quite complicated correlated wave functions as a result. In particular, these degeneracies are caused, in the case we're talking about, by having a finite amount of angular momentum and asking how it's shared around amongst the different particles, atoms in the trap. So let me perhaps state, there are various different ways of stating what one means by weak interactions. Perhaps one of the more physical ways is to make a comment about the healing length or coherence length of the particles in the trap. And one can define it this way, where A is the scattering length and rho is the density. And crudely speaking, the interpretation of physical significance of this length scale, psi, is that for length scales greater than it, the interactions between the particles are the dominant thing, and for interactions less than it, then the single particle kinetic energy, for instance, has an important role to play. So the Thomas Fermi limit that many people have worked on and is certainly highly appropriate to many bits of physics is looking always at the physics and regime on a length scale that's rather bigger than this. So we're going to turn our back on that and go off in a rather different direction. And it's going to be the limit where the coherence length is greater than the size of the trap. And this again goes with the proviso at the top. You might think this is a very dull and sterile limit, but in fact it has surprisingly interesting phenomena. I shrink from using the word rich after Mark Edwards used it earlier on today, but I think there is actually some diversity in the results that make them quite interesting. However, at this point I should also come clean. Although the motivation for doing this I think is partly conceptual, that maybe it will help shed some light on the more typical regime that people work in, I think I should point out that if one really wanted to do experiments in this regime, it's quite difficult because the number of atoms you could have in current traps I think would be rather small.
Population of interaction is more than several levels, you have opposite situation always.
Yes, but as you correctly say, really one only wants to work with the case where the interactions are weaker than the level spacing. Yes. It's a very limited case, sure. I mean, that's why I'm stressing that that is true.
You mentioned all times Thomas Fermi. Thomas Fermi is not working.
In this limit?
Yes.
Yeah, that's sure. That's the whole point. We're going to do something very different from Thomas Fermi. Sure. Okay, now, having pointed out the experimental limitations of this regime, let me perhaps say one or two things in its favor. First of all, there's no problems with homogeneity, as we will see. We really can talk in quite general terms about what happens when you make the particles have a finite angular momentum in this regime and ask how it's distributed amongst them. There are no difficulties with edges. In some sense, the whole thing is an edge. The vortices, if one had vortices, their cores would now be the same size as the trap or bigger. So somehow the whole place is the edge. And in a certain sense, that's also a selling point. It could be that, in fact, this picture is an appropriate way of discussing what happens at the edge of the real, more strongly interacting cases as well. And as I also wanted to stress, that one should be rather careful in thinking about the limit of zero interaction strength and the approach to this rather dull ideal Bose gas, because, in fact, one has to go through this rather singular regime, at least for a purely harmonic trap, and a circularly symmetric harmonic trap where mean field theory really is not very valid. So those are the comments to argue that there is indeed some point in thinking about this. So what I want to do now is to first of all discuss the physics of how you would take an ideal Bose gas, so this really is the simple case, and how you would ask if you wanted to minimize the energy subject to a constraint that you had a certain amount of angular momentum shared amongst the atoms in the trap, which energy levels would you actually choose to populate if you want to do that minimization? So the aim we are going to do here is consider the single particle states initially before we turn on the weak interactions. We want to ask, how do we minimize the energy subject to constraint of the total angular momentum being non-zero? Now, those of you who perhaps have thought about rotating things before may start to feel uncomfortable here and ask, why am I not talking about adion terms of the Hamiltonian like minus omega dot L and so on? And I'll come back to that right at the end of the talk. For the moment, let me actually phrase it this way, that we're dealing with states of fixed total angular momentum and asking how we minimize the energy. Now, the first point to observe is a rather obvious one, but I think it's worth pointing out, that the constraint of the total angular momentum being non-zero prevents all the particles sitting in the single particle ground state. So one really has to address the question about how one distributes them around what would be the excited single particle states for the case with zero total angular momentum. And the degeneracy in the states we'll come to deal with purely comes about from asking, how does one share this angular momentum around amongst the different particles in the trap? And it will transpire that there are many different ways to do this, and it's that degeneracy that then is lifted by the interactions between the particles. So let's think first of all physically how we would gauge which states we should use to populate to carry out this minimization, and then I'll give the actual expression mathematically for what we're doing. So if we imagine our particles in our three-dimensional trap, let me assume all the frequencies are the same for the moment. Then we consider we're going to have angular momentum along one axis. Let's call that the z-axis just for the sake of argument. Then it's clear that in terms of minimizing the energy, we certainly do not want any energy in oscillations parallel to the axis that the angular momentum points along, because those oscillations, if you like, have got no angular momentum associated with them, so they just cost you energy. So basically you want no quanta in your oscillator oscillating parallel to the axis where the angular momentum is along. Similarly, if you now think about the plane whose normal is the angular momentum vector, you don't want to put any energy into oscillations which are purely radial, because again, they are associated with no angular momentum, so they don't help you satisfy the constraint, but they certainly cost you energy. So thinking purely physically leads you immediately to the conclusion that you want to put no energy into oscillations parallel to the z-axis where L points along, and no energy into oscillations in the radial direction. So what's left? Well, what's left is the following. Here is the expression for the single particle energy levels in a 3D oscillator, where we've chosen cylindrical polar coordinates to do it in just for ease. Here is the energy associated with oscillations parallel to the axis along L. Here is a term due to radial oscillations, and here is the bit that's left that's due to the angular momentum being non-zero. So all I'm saying so far is that to minimize this energy, we want to certainly put these two quantum numbers equal to zero for all the particles, and then merely address the point about what states we're left with in terms of the m's. However, we can say one more thing very quickly, which is the following, that since the energy is proportional to the modulus of m, there is no advantage in populating states whose m's are anti-parallel or negative with respect to L. Because to satisfy the constraint of fixed L, you have to have even bigger angular momenta which are positive to compensate, and the sum of their energies will be higher than if you didn't do that. So the final endpoint is that one makes these two numbers both zero, and one only chooses numbers here which are either zero or positive. Now, that may sound very involved, but we'll see in a moment it leads you to things which are familiar from another bit of physics, in fact. So, coming back to just talk about degeneracy now, we've ended up deciding the states we want to deal with at a single particle level look like this, where m is the angular momentum quantum number. So you can see that if you want to add up to a given total angular momentum like this, where m is the number of quanta in a particle, and this is a number of particles with eigenvalue m, then there are many, many ways to do this. I mean, at a trivial level, let's imagine the total angular momentum was 2, then obviously you could pick 2 particles to have 1 or 1 particle to have 2. But if you then think about numbers of quanta of angular momenta, which are, say, n, where n is the number of particles, which would be a candidate for a vortex, then indeed there are many, many different ways in which you could actually assemble n quanta out of these states. So that's where the degeneracy comes from, is the different ways of satisfying this constraint. Let me just note in passing what the wave functions look like. I mean, this specific form actually won't matter too much in the future, but just those of you who've seen it before, the wave functions you're left with are, in fact, here functions x and y. I've not mentioned the behavior of the axis. In terms of the complex variable z equals x plus iy, you can write that in this rather compact form, and these are exactly the states in the lowest Landau level which people use to talk about the fractional and ordinary integer quantum Hall effects. So, where have we got to? So far, we have not, in fact, introduced interactions at all. All I've said is, if we look at the single particle states and imagine what set of states we want to use to try and minimize the energy, then there are a rather limited set of states. One throws away all oscillations up the axis parallel to the angular momentum, all the radial oscillations, and you're purely left with things which have nodes in the azimuthal direction, i.e. like this. So, now what we're going to do is take this set of states and ask, once we turn on weak interactions, then what are the ground states like, with fixed total angular momentum, and how do they differ between the two different signs of scattering length? So let's, for instance, first of all, think about positive scattering length. And we sort of do get a vortex for positive scattering length, something you might interpret as a vortex, but it's not completely straightforward, so let me just lead you through that. If we were trying to make a vortex from these wave functions, the ones which obey those various constraints, the natural way to write it down would be in the following way. We have a condensate because all the particles are in the same state. This product runs over the particles from 1 to n. We have one quantum of angular momentum for each particle, and then we have the Gaussian, the ordinary Gaussian from the two other, the x and y directions. So this is a condensate of each particle having one quantum of angular momentum, and roughly speaking looks like the core of a kind of traditional vortex, if you want to put it that way. So that's actually not quite what we find. What we find, and this is a result which is a conjecture in a sense, because we know that it's correct for up to 6 particles from using Mathematica, but our guess is this is correct for all the more than that, is that the wave function looks like the following thing. It looks like a vortex, but the vortex is actually rotating not around the origin, but around the center of mass. But the center of mass is defined this way.
In Fermi case, we have the such that on that, because the particle cannot be on a, in one place due to Fermi statistic, what is the origin of zero when that E equals?
Oh, this thing. This is the center of mass coordinate. So this is not vanishing when two particles come together. It vanishes when each particle is at the center of mass. I'm not explaining why that's true, I'm just saying it is true.
This is the result of Mathematica.
Yeah. So it's quite a strange thing. But I'm going to say something in a few minutes that in fact implies the appearance of this variable is rather less important than it might seem. And in fact, the picture of the vortex as being like this is not a bad one. But let me first of all say what happens when the scattering length is negative. When the scattering length is negative, you don't find a vortex. And what you do find is that the angular momentum is absorbed by the center of mass motion. So the center of mass moves around the track with angular momentum L. This is actually true for all L, and in fact one can prove this without the aid of Mathematica. So L equals N is a special case, but it's true in general, and it obviously is a very different form because you don't have any single coordinate here, or the single coordinates don't occur underneath the product sign, you have this sum and then a power. So it's really a very different form of state. One can also write down the energy, but that is perhaps not so interesting. And I suppose one way to interpret this is that the angular momentum has been taken up by a sort of collective mode where the center of mass moves around the origin rather than by having a vortex. We can also observe, again this is not a proof, but it seems to be true for the states we've looked at, that the excited states have a particularly simple form. One can actually understand this in an intuitive way. The interactions are like delta functions, remember in this description where one's using the scattering length approximation, so that if you put nodes in the many-particle wave function when the particles come together, if the interactions are attractive, the energy goes up. So it's perhaps not very surprising that the first excited state actually looks like something where you ensure that the wave function vanishes for each pair, symmetrized over the pairs, and that removes two particles from benefiting from this attractive interaction. And obviously this is slightly reminiscent to those of you who are familiar with things that you might get in something like a Laughlin state. So you're creating a node when these two come together, and so they can't experience their mutual attraction, and so the energy goes up. So that's the excited state. So let's now take a step back and ask if this is some general phenomenon, and come to ask questions which perhaps spring to mind now, which is, if you looked at that case with the negative scattering length for the attractive interactions where the center of mass takes up the angular momentum, you might, for instance, be interested to ask whether that looks condensed or not. So is there really a Bose condensate there or not? You could also ask that of the repulsive case where you've got this funny center of mass behavior and ask whether that thing looks condensed or not. So we'll come on to that in a moment, but let me give a slightly historical interlude here where some of the ideas came up from other people in the past, which in fact shed a bit of light in this. And it's really what the role of degeneracy in the single particle levels and the exchange energy is for Bose systems, and certainly the person who I know who realized this, perhaps the first was Nozier, but there may be other people who I don't know who realized this. And he noticed that there really is quite an important distinction in the role of the exchange energy in distinguishing positive and negative interactions or positive and negative scattering lengths. And to see that, let's look at a simple example. The simple example is we have two bosons and two single particle states, and we'll come back to the serious example in a moment of the ones we were looking at. But let's look at the toy problem first. We have two bosons and two single particle states, A and B. And let's then consider the following three two-particle states, which are consistent with Bose statistics. Both the particles in A, both in B, or a symmetric superposition of them being in A and B. And let's assume that the single particle energies are degenerate. So that's appropriate for this case we've been talking about with the angular momenta. Okay, let's keep on being ruthlessly simple-minded about this. Let's add some interactions on now, but let's assume they're all the same. So this is just the Hartree term if you have both particles in A. This is the Hartree term when you've got both particles in B. And these are the Hartree and exchange terms when you've got one particle in A and one particle in B. And let's assume all these matrix elements are equal to the same constant for simplicity. Then it's clear that thinking at the Hartree-Fock level, the expectation of the energy is then V in state A, V in state B, and 2V in state AB, basically because there are four terms here and two factors, 1 over root 2. So if V is greater than 0, then clearly the ground state is condensed, meaning it wants to be one of these two things. And that was Nozier's observation in the past. And his implicit observation was that, and he commented on it in an earlier paper, was that if V is less than 0, then this logic goes into reverse, and this state has got a lower energy. Because EAB is now minus 2V, 2 mod V, and you get this so-called fragmented condensate that he and St. James thought of in the 80s, although other people had also thought of that, as I'll mention in a moment slightly earlier. So this is the motivation for inquiring of our results whether the states are condensed or not. It's an implication that interactions can sometimes prefer states to be uncondensed rather than condensed if the interactions are attractive. So let's see if that's true in a moment. Okay, so obviously we want to ask about the negative scattering length case with the total angular momentum being non-zero. Is this a case where the state may be not condensed by that logic? These things were both thought about before by Girardot in the early 60s in a sort of general context, and more specifically in thinking about excitonic BEC by Nozier in the early 80s. Perhaps just as a tangent, it's worth commenting something which often, I think, surprises people when they first notice it, is that if you stick an obstacle in a current, if you have particles which don't interact, they scatter off the obstacle. It's quite striking, of course, if you put an obstacle in the way of a sort of nonlinear Schrödinger beam or a supercurrent, if you're thinking a condensed matter way, that the thing flows around it but doesn't scatter, at least not to some critical velocity. So this is A greater than 0, this is A equals 0, and of course it's perhaps entertaining to ask whether if you could send a pulse of negative scattering length particles at an obstacle, maybe one finds there's enhanced scattering due to exchange. So that's just a by the way. So let's go back now and ask whether these various states are condensed, the sort of pseudo-vortex in the case of the positive scattering length and the center of mass taking up the angular momentum in the case of negative scattering length. And we'll use a definition of condensation which Yang invented in the early 60s. And the definition is slightly technical, but it's really just saying that if you form the single particle density matrix, And this definition is particularly useful when one's dealing with inhomogeneous situations, and one can't just talk about k equals zero and so on. If one forms a single particle density matrix and wishes to ask, does the state you formed it from have a condensate or not, then one way to define a condensate is to say, if you look at the eigenvalues of that matrix, and you find there's one eigenvalue which is of order unity, and the rest are go down as the system size gets bigger, then, and I'm being a little bit slack about this, but this is roughly speaking true, then one has a condensate in the associated eigenvector, and that's called the condensate wave function. So this is particularly useful in situations which are inhomogeneous, or where, in principle, you could have a single particle state, you have no idea whether it's condensed or not. And this is a way, not a single, many particle state, you have no idea whether it's condensed or not. This would be a way of finding out. And indeed, this is the way we have inquired whether the states we've been talking about are condensed or not. So for a greater than zero, what one can see is that as n goes to infinity, and L equals n, the case we talked about, the putative single vortex, then the largest eigenvalue does indeed tend to 1, and so we can in fact say that this is a fully condensed state. So the center of mass contributions actually become completely irrelevant in that limit. So for the repulsive case, one has something that looks like the core of a vortex, and it looks condensed. For the negative scattering length case, things are slightly more complicated. Let's focus on a particular set of possible amount of angular momenta. Let's imagine L is Q times M, where Q is an integer, and Q is somewhere that's it's much bigger than 1, but much less than N. And if you're dealing with helium, this might be the regime you'd be seeing a vortex lattice in, for instance. What you find there is that you get roughly the square root of Q eigenvalues, which is magnitude 1 over root Q, centered on M equals Q. So you don't have a single condensate. You have some funny blurred out thing. We've got no dominant eigenvalue in many of the same order. This situation does retain some qualities of a condensate, which Girardot has shown again in the 60s, this type of situation. And indeed, one can actually write this state as a superposition of different condensates. But I won't mention that at the moment. One thing one might then ask is, how generic are these results? Given I've now moved slightly away from atom traps and said that there are these general ideas of Nozier that would make you think that attractive interactions maybe lead to things which aren't condensed, and repulsive interactions which do lead to condensates. So although the interactions we were looking at were exactly the appropriate ones for an interaction parameterized by a scattering length, one can ask, what happens if you change this a bit? And one of the cases that one can look at, again, because one can solve it exactly, which is somehow the difficulty in this case, is finding things you can solve exactly, is the case of harmonic interactions, which have also been looked at by a group in Antwerp. And what one finds is that this should be a big lambda here, being positive and negative. For the attractive case here, again, the thing is not condensed, and for the positive case, it is. So it's an interesting parallel. Well, let me just finish up by making a few comments about connections with the fractional quantum Hall effect. Clearly, the parallels are not exact, because one is dealing with particles which are bosons and not fermions. And in fact, one's also dealing with occupations of this Lewis Landau level analog, which are much bigger than 1 typically, rather than fractions of 1. So it's not a straightforward relationship, but there is nevertheless some relationship. And perhaps one interesting thing, which is an entirely hypothetical question in the case of helium, is whether if you make helium rotate, there is some maximum angular velocity above which the system is either not condensed or not superfluid or both. And this is by analogy with the upper critical magnetic field in superconductors. So by analogy with HC2 and a type 2 superconductor, what you might estimate this critical velocity, angular critical velocity to be would be one vortex threading an area which was the coherence length squared. And if you try and estimate that in helium 4, it's an absolutely colossal angular velocity and clearly completely unattainable in a lab. So the question about whether there's condensation or superfluidity above that angular frequency is really irrelevant for helium, but maybe is not quite so irrelevant in the case of the atom traps. So let me just say something about that for a moment. It's interesting to note that one can show by just a trivial extension and argument that these people gave, Gorse and Trugmann gave in the fermion case of the fractional effect, that if you take an angular momentum which is n into n minus 1, which of course is, again, is a big angular momentum, you've got n minus 1 quanta for each particle, then the ground state you can demonstrate very straightforwardly is a Laughlin state. And the reason it's very straightforward is, again, that for the repulsive interactions, you just remove the interactions for each pair by having this factor of Zi minus Zj squared. So all the interactions add up to give you zero. Of course, the problem with it, again, experimentally, is that when you've got so much angular momentum, the gas is very spread out, and that probably precludes us, at least in present-day traps, but I think it would be a very interesting thing to ask about. It's certainly a much more accessible thing probably within atom traps than it would be within helium-4. And this estimate, this is interesting to note, that this angular momentum is roughly equivalent to what you'd have with omega C2 for helium. Right, one final connection with the Hall effect and then I'll wrap up. The real connection with the Hall effect is made most manifest if you actually do think about minimizing this Hamiltonian, which is the original one minus omega dot L, which is one way at least of thinking about what happens if you go into rotating reference frame and minimize the energy in that. The striking thing there is if you write down, again, not worrying about the interactions at the moment, if you write down the single particle energies for H and for the omega dot L bit, what you note is that if omega naught equals omega, so if the thing rotates at the same frequency as a trap, of course these two terms cancel for positive M. So all the states are actually degenerate in that case. Of course, for omega bigger than omega naught, the thing's unstable, and that of course reflects the fact that in the harmonic oscillator there's only one angular velocity that's possible, which is the velocity of going around the trap. It's either zero or omega naught, and that's why this thing's unstable. But exactly at the moment before it's unstable, in fact, you get the degeneracy. And that degeneracy, in fact, is identical to the lowest Landau level in the fractional quantum Hall effect. And there, NR, in fact, plays the role of the Landau level index. It's identical to that. So at the moment of instability in the rotating frame, one is exactly in the regime where the fractional quantum Hall effect occurs there. So let me just conclude, and then I'll stop. So we focus on this weak interaction limit, which hopefully will shed some light on how angular momentum is carried in condensates, perhaps of a less dilute and larger form. The suggestion is that the way the angular momentum is resides in the system is very different for the cases of positive and negative scattering lengths. For the positive scattering length case, we do find, at least for L equals M, we have something that resembles a vortex. But for the negative scattering length, we find that we have nothing like that, and the center of mass takes up the angular momentum. The latter thing is not a simple condensate. There is this interesting connection between a Laughlin state at high angular momentum and what you would have thought with omega C2 in a helium case. And then, of course, finally, in between the Laughlin state and the one vortex case, there are all sorts of possibilities which we are currently thinking about. So thank you very much.
Ground state subject to this constraint that you have a fixed
It seems to me that if you just change your state very slightly by moving the vortices around, for example, that your energy shouldn't change so much. So it seems like, in that sense, you're very close to being in a condensed state. So that somehow you're... there's a whole collection of states which are very close together and can be considered... would you agree with that?
If what you're saying is that there you have this thing where you've got the eigenvalues of density matrix spread over this thing that's like root Q, if you're saying you could take a wave packet of different angular momenta whose values spread over the same value, you could then form something which looked like a wave packet that was rolling around, then I'd agree with you. But that might be I thought that might be the thing you actually were driving at, but...
Yeah, I mean, something like that, but
not
necessarily that.
Yeah, so...
There's many different sort of dynamical things which would look...
Well, it's not actually... It's still quite a big difference. I mean, you are talking about the square root of the number of vortices and the thing. So if the number of vortices is, you can... In helium, you can actually count them and make several of them, then the square root's a significant number to have a fluctuation in terms of the angular momentum. Well, the energy difference would be sort of the number of particles times the square root of Q or something.
May I ask you, if you have negative A,
yeah,
at the same time you have a real density, then A is, the system is sensitive to A.
So you mean when it's at high density and is about to be unstable?
Fermi you mentioned from time to time.
Well, we were never in the Thomas Fermi regime, of course.
But nevertheless, I want to ask you, what is it preventing from collapse?
Oh, the...
Because doesn't the collapse, the part of the momentum or rotational momentum can take molecules and go away. That's why the existence at the beginning, orbital moment, don't prevent from collapse.
I think I'm not quite sure I quite get your point. What one can say is that it's the actual level structure of the oscillator which is preventing the collapse.
Only in the case when you have, from the beginning, the requirement that NA interaction will be essentially, or at least, in some extent less than distance between them.
Yeah, sure, that's the limit we've been working in the whole time.
But at the same time, you try to work in a large energy due to orbital moment. You introduce in the system large energy.
Yeah.
So, and that's why, in principle, you have the situation when, by fluctuation, you can have some collapse and removing a part of the rotational moment by molecule.
Well, of course you're right, but in the same way, of course, you can tunnel even in the regime where the where you have no angular momentum and you have the things in the ground state and the interactions are weak. It's still metastable, of course, with respect to collapse. So I don't really understand why the metastability is different in the two cases.
Yeah, perhaps I can rephrase the question. I think maybe your question is that if I project everything at the lowest lambda level, then I would still have an interaction, which four-point interaction, which is there's a negative coefficient. Then that is proportional to n squared. Then why wouldn't I be seeing the collapse of n squared? As well as the lowest lambda level still has a...
Well, okay. I mean, partly I can answer that in the following way, which is that... in a sense, if one looks at how the state actually looks, I said you could write it as a superposition of condensates. This state can be written in this form, where you can rewrite the center of mass times this thing. I'm just focusing on the center of mass coordinate. The other ones actually don't matter very much for the sake of this argument. You can write that as a superposition of something that looks like a thing that's just condensed, weighted by a phase factor like this and this amplitude here. So somehow, in a way, you're looking at a superposition of states which are identical to the things sitting in the ground state. So it's a bit hard, again, for me to see why the matrix elements for decay should be enhanced just because the thing's rotating.
No, but it's a collective phenomenon. It's not a phenomenon connected with the individual part. Even in case condensate when the interaction less than distance between levels, we have in principle tunneling even for coming to the state of collapsing state. But in your case, you introduce a very large energy in the system by rotation.
Mm-hmm.
And you have the population of but different levels by many ways.
Oh, sure. But my point is it's all in the center of mass. So the relative wave function looks very much the same. So that's why I'm saying to deform this relative wave function, to make it smaller, the processes involved are actually pretty well the same as they would be if the thing wasn't rotating. It's because you're not deforming the relative wave function when you multiply by this factor. So it's not as though you're pushing them together or anything to make the possibility of decay stronger. So you really have to compress the relative wave function to, I think, to have what you're saying, and I think that relies on the same processes that you would need at zero angular momentum, because the state is basically just identical to that in terms of its relative structure. Well, that's a difficult question, I mean, as you, of course, are aware, it really would require us to, if one wanted to define it in, as the response of the system to the omega dot L term for omega small, one would really have to deform the trap from being circular and then do that analysis and then take the limit of the thing being circular at the end, as you pointed out the other day. We haven't actually done that. If you wanted to interpret it somewhat more loosely in terms of trying to ask if it looked like the energy looked like L squared over 2i, then you get a rather different answer. It doesn't look terribly superfluid. That's what you're getting at. But in terms of the process, which I think is the most fundamental definition of it, we haven't done that yet.
You made a comment about the stability of vortices. Could you just summarize what can we learn about that? For the stability of vortices.
Okay. I think it's a good question. I think really one can learn probably rather little from it, in the sense that although we certainly find a vortex is stable in this limit of weak interactions, I'd be rather hesitant to say that implied that it's in fact stable for the regime where Thomas Fermi is valid. I mean, my own impression is actually there, from some of the discussions that have gone on while I've been here, is that the picture, which may be more accurate, is that the angular momentum does reside in excitations at the surface of the droplet, and the vortices are unstable. But then the motivation, in part, from what we're doing here is, you are pushed into a regime where the angular momentum resides in a region where the density is rather low, and hence the interactions are rather weak. And again, maybe this has a lesson. But it would not be... So one could say that maybe our vortex wave function is what the thing looks like a large distance from the trap, but I think it's rather implausible. I think it may be that things like that have some possibilities for describing what does happen if the angular momentum in the Thomas Fermi limit does end up residing in the state of lowest energy in the fringes of the condensate, but I wouldn't want to say anything more powerful than that. However, I think in the attractive case, it's a more potent argument, actually. Oh. Yeah, well, it's somehow in there pretty early on. Let me just find the transparency. Okay, in a sense it's already there, because you have got this node where Z is zero in the center of the trap. As I said, the real state actually, that the node exists at the center of mass, which is a dynamical thing, except in the thermodynamic limit where it becomes a C number, but it's a dynamical thing initially. So, topological perhaps is slightly grand for this representation, but there is a node there in the center of the trap, and there is a node at the center of mass there. Yeah.
But you were discussing essentially a thermodynamic equilibrium situation.
Well, zero temperature, if I'm being brutal.
In the sense that you have fixed this total angular momentum.
Sort of, yeah, that's right.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I would have thought that topological considerations, by and large, only came into the consideration of noticeability.
You mean how you can get rid of angular momentum, for instance? Although somehow, again, there still is the issue. I mean, this whole issue about the stability of vortices, if it transpires, they are unstable in the Thomas-Fermi limit and tend to head off towards the edges of the trap. If the trap is isolated, the angular momentum has to go somewhere. And so the question there is, where does it go to? Assuming you're not applying any torques from outside or anything. So you're right about the meta stability, but somehow there's still an end point to that stability, and you can still ask where does the angular momentum end up residing, even if it doesn't want to be stuck in a vortex, it has to be somewhere. And in helium you've got no option because there aren't any edges, but here there are edges, and that's when you come into the regime again where maybe we have something to say. Thank you.